This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Hour number two of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. This past summer, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court called on judges to issue an arrest warrant for the president of Sudan. The charge? War crimes committed in Sudan's western Darfur region. It has been estimated that at least 200,000 people have died there since 2003. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about Darfur, the conflict there, and what's going on today, as we talk with Fabian Hara from the International Crisis Group in New York. We'll also be talking about some of the worries that have been voiced that the peace agreement that brought an end to the country's long civil war pitting the North against the South may be on the verge of collapse. Other questions are certainly welcome in this hour of the show. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you're interested in calling in and asking questions, that's certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of the callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so that we could keep moving. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Fabian Hara, has been with the Crisis Group since February of this year. She serves as Vice President for Multilateral Affairs. She oversees the Crisis Group's advocacy at the United Nations and the Security Council in New York, and also directs the Crisis Group's New York office. She has over 15 years of experience in African conflict management and resolution issues, including in Sudan. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as I said, questions are certainly welcome. So at any point you'd like to join us, you're welcome to do that. Ms. Hara, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let us begin by talking a little bit about Darfur. It is something certainly that has gotten news coverage, and perhaps people are aware that there has been this long-running conflict with very serious consequences for many, many people being displaced, and a great number, and depending on what story you read, the numbers may be different, but they all run to six figures, hundreds of thousands of people having been killed. I'm not sure how well people understand, I would not claim to understand very well what this conflict is about. So perhaps that might be, again, a good place to start to say basically what's been going on now all these 5 years there.
Well, let me start maybe by saying a little bit about the root causes of the conflict. This is a conflict that has three dimensions. One is the local dimension, the national dimension, and then a regional dimension. The local dimension, first, at the root of much of the conflict is the competition over fertile land and water, which has been exacerbated by desertification in northern Sudan and drought that has affected some parts of Darfur. There has been a drive by nomadic tribes, mainly Arab tribes, to occupy land in the south of Darfur, and this had created conflicts with the farmers in the area. So the ethnicity has become a mobilizing factor in political discourse in the years before the conflict broke out, Arabs versus African tribes, basically. The two groups accused each other of wanting to take over the land. So that's basically the local dimension. And there is also a national dimension to the conflict. There is a general problem in Sudan between the center and the peripheries. The center has always had a very exploitative relationship towards the peripheries, and certainly the Darfur people have felt very marginalized from central power. And this, by the way, is also the reason why the southern Sudanese have taken up weapons right after independence of Sudan. And finally, the regional dimension, there are many tribal links between Chad and Sudan, and there has been a proxy war going on between the two countries since the beginning of the Darfur conflict, with the Chadian government supporting some of the Darfur rebels and the Sudanese government supporting now the Chadian rebels.
You pointed out the fact that there are these different levels, and that partly it is about local people competing over local resources. At the same time, the allegation has been made, and this is how it is we get to the charge against Mr. al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, that the government of Sudan in Khartoum has aided and abetted the Arabs who are fighting in the side of on one side in this local conflict, and in fact that they have thrown resources, government resources, into this conflict on their side, and which is something that consistently the government has denied doing. They said, no, we have not done that. What has been the role? How has the government been involved in this conflict, and have they indeed weighed in on one side?
First of all, it's important to note that some of the populations of Darfur, particularly African tribes, decided to organize themselves and take up weapons against the government in 2003. The government's response to this has been pretty much the same in Darfur as it was in southern Sudan. There is, of course, an army, the SAF, you know, the South Sudanese Armed Forces, but this is an army that basically provides, you know, logistics and rear bases for the infantry. And the infantry has essentially been recruited in the case of Darfur, in the Arab tribes. So the government has recruited what we now call the Janjaweed, some of the horsemen, basically coming from the Arab tribes, to fight on its behalf. And these people have been helped massively by the Sudanese army to organize massive campaigns of killings and violence, and basically terror campaigns in many places in Darfur. And that has led to the flight of about 2 million people who are now in IDP camps, in internally displaced people camps. So the role of the government of Sudan has been to support the militias with massive military infrastructure and weapons to fight against the rebels. The technique that they have used, as I said, was essentially scorched earth policy. They have pushed these militias into villages to terrorize people and make them flee. So there is obviously a responsibility of the government of Sudan in the response to the civil war. There has been disproportionate use of force. There is no question about it. And a lot of crimes against humanity have been committed. But I just want to stress here that we are still talking about a war. We are talking about a war that has a political route, basically, and still needs a political solution.
Well, then, one of the things we have to acknowledge is that the International Criminal Court does not have a police force. They rely on countries that are a party to the court to comply, and in fact that has happened. It seems in this case unlikely that the government of Sudan would turn the president over to the criminal court. Do you really expect anything to, if indeed the arrest warrant is issued, and I think it has not actually happened yet, if indeed that happens, do you think that that would have any practical consequences?
Well, indeed, in terms of the process, the judges of the criminal court are now weighing the prosecutor's evidence, and they are going to decide probably in October or November whether or not to issue an arrest warrant. As you mentioned, it will be extremely difficult to implement the warrant, as it is the first time, really, that such an accusation is made against a president who is in power. And there is very little chance that the government of Sudan will arrest its own president, obviously. So it will be, even if the warrant is issued, it will be extremely difficult to implement this this arrest warrant. Now, of course, politically, this will have a lot of different impacts, and we are still basically weighing the risks and opportunities for peace in Sudan. I don't know if you've seen what the International Crisis Group has put out. We've put out a press release and a number of op-eds and so on, going into this debate quite in detail. And what we're saying basically is that this process could advance the interests of peace. It's possible that the increased pressure now placed on the government of Sudan will lead it to take long overdue steps to cease all violence, implement genuine and credible measures to resolve the Darfur crisis, for example, allow the deployment of the peacekeeping force, and also fully carry out its bargain to implement the North-South Peace Agreement. But we're also saying that there are very significant risks for stability in Sudan. And, you know, first of all, there are two peace processes right now being, you know, in which the government of Sudan is a participant. There's the North-South Peace Process. I mean, they have signed an agreement with the SPLM, the Southern Sudan Liberation Movement, which basically establishes a government of national unity. It's in place. It has a power-sharing protocol, a wealth-sharing protocol, a ceasefire protocol. There should be elections next year, and there will be a referendum on self-determination of Southern Sudan in 2011. And this is a very fragile process, which the accusation against the president could destabilize. There's no question about it. And, of course, President Bashir will be a candidate in the national elections next year. And it could also completely hinder the efforts to deploy a peacekeeping force in Darfur or even to restart the peace process in Darfur. So this is a very hard policy choice now that will have to be made by the Security Council of the United Nations, balancing risk and opportunity. Even if we are all in agreement that the Sudanese regime has failed in its responsibility to protect its own people, the Security Council will have to make this decision and this judgment as to whether Khartoum can be pressured to stop the violence, build a new, you know, government, a new peace and stability arrangement in letting the court proceed. I mean, this is a very complicated issue, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I want to take just a moment here to introduce again our guest, Fabienne Hara. She's Vice President for Multilateral Affairs at the International Crisis Group in New York. We're talking about Sudan and Darfur, and we'll continue in just a moment. First, though, we need just to pause for about 30 seconds to do a transmitter switch. We will do that, so please stay tuned. This is Focus 580. And again, this morning in this hour of the program, we are talking with Fabienne Hara. She is with the International Crisis Group. She is in New York. She's been with the organization since February of this year. She's Vice President of Multilateral Affairs and oversees the group's advocacy at the UN and the Security Council in New York. She has over 15 years of experience in African conflict management and resolution issues, and we're talking about Sudan. So I just, again, to sort of round out what you said before, that obviously there was a fairly wide range of reaction to the action of the court. Some people favored it. Some people said it would make things more difficult. Some people said it was counterproductive. So it sounds as if you're saying it's not easy to actually answer that question.
Right. I mean, the Security Council, just to give you an idea of the dilemma that the Security Council has to face, the Security Council has mandated two peacekeeping missions in Sudan, one to support the North-South Peace Agreement. It's called UNMISS. It's now in place. It has over 10,000 peacekeepers in southern Sudan. And it's supporting the program of reform, the program of democratization of Sudan, and then possibly the referendum for self-determination of southern Sudan in 2011. The same Security Council has also mandated a joint hybrid African Union United Nations force into Darfur. This force has had, you know, the worst difficulties deploying, mainly because the government of Sudan has obstructed its deployment almost systematically. But there is an agreement in principle for this force. So the question really for the Council is, what happens to these other mandates given to the UN? What happens to the other peace processes? What happens to the decisions that the Security Council itself made? It has referred the crimes of Darfur to the criminal court and at the same time mandated the UN to support peace processes in Sudan. So there is a huge dilemma. I think it's probably the first time it's facing its kind of dilemma in its 62 years of history. And now the question that is before the Council, or will be soon before the Council, is whether the prosecution of, you know, President Bashir for atrocities against its own people should be put on hold in the larger interests of peace and security. And the council is very divided on that at this stage.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about some of the difficulties faced by the peacekeepers in Darfur. Mm-hmm. The concern, I think, of a lot of people is that it is severely understaffed, that it was supposed to be 26,000, and they really only have about a third of that number. They don't have the equipment that they need. They're under a lot of pressure. They're having a very difficult time. And indeed, do you put up mostly that to the lack of cooperation from the government, or has there been some issue about commitment to this mission by member states?
Well, I think there are three categories of problems here. I mean, one is definitely the obstruction by the government of Sudan. It has been extremely difficult to get the consent of the government of Sudan for the deployment of a peacekeeping force into Darfur. They have resisted it for quite a number of months, and they were under intense pressure by the international community. Finally, they gave their agreement, but they put all kinds of conditions to attach to that. For example, that the troops serving in this peacekeeping force should be only African, or mainly African, as they stipulated in the agreement. And obviously, they don't want to see a huge peacekeeping force in Darfur. First of all, because, and that's the case throughout Africa, it sends the message to the people of Sudan that this government is a failed government, that Sudan is a failed state, and no government likes that. They need to project an image of strength in Khartoum. And then, importantly, I think they fear also that this robust peacekeeping force in Darfur will at some point be mandated by the Security Council to possibly arrest some of the criminals indicted by the ICC. And you know, that means obviously a number of Janjaweed leaders, a number of leaders of the Arab tribes and militia tribes, which could also destabilize the government. I mean, if one or two or three get arrested, then, you know, many others will turn against the government. So there are lots of issues there for the government. The second problem, obviously, is that this mission is deployed in a place that has the size of France. There are no roads, no infrastructure. Everything is difficult. The UN had to buy the land to build the camps, basically, to accommodate the peacekeepers. There's a need for water for 26,000 people, and that's very, very expensive and very difficult to achieve. There are all kinds of logistical obstacles to the deployment of this force. And thirdly, I would say, and importantly also, there is indeed a question of commitment by the troop contributing countries, to use the jargon used by the Department of Peacekeeping Operations here. This is an environment in which there is no peace to keep. So the troops contributing to this force have to agree that they may face very difficult situation on the ground, very challenging, very dangerous situation on the ground. And there are few countries that actually are willing to do that.
Well, this one of the things that I was interested in having you talk about is how perhaps the nature of the conflict in Darfur has changed. You talked in the beginning about the fact that you have to think about it along a couple of dimensions, about certainly that this was a local conflict over local resources, but that also that it was a conflict that had to do with the fact that people here in the region felt that their needs and their interests were being neglected by the government in Khartoum. So in a sense, partly what they were doing in attacking interests of the government in Darfur was trying to get the attention of the government in Khartoum, saying, look, we're part of the country too, and we're not sharing in whatever benefits there are to be had here. It seems as if, and so early in the conflict, it seemed fairly clear that there were two sides. There were the rebels on one side, and there were the Janjaweed militia backed by the government on the other. And that now, though, what we've got to a point where it's a little bit more difficult to identify one side and the other. The conflict seems to be more diffuse, and more in more different groups fighting with each other, maybe on the side of the rebels, not so much unity as there once was, and it sounds like it's devolved into a kind of a warlordism. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to point out that the dynamics on the ground have changed somehow. The rebels have always had, complex leadership, if I may say so. And indeed, with the conflict dragging on, the rebel leadership has divided further. It has divided also through the peace process. And there was this peace process in Abuja that led to a first peace agreement that immediately collapsed afterwards, mainly because the rebels were divided and some of them signed the peace agreement and others didn't. So there is complete division and fragmentation on the rebel side, which of course makes it extremely difficult to restart the peace process. I mean, this is one of the major obstacles to the peace process in Darfur. The government, for its part, has always said that it was ready to talk to the rebels, but the rebels themselves cannot agree on a strategy for the peace talks, on a vision for the peace talks. So that's one of the important elements here that has changed indeed since 2003. The other element is that Indeed, there is fragmentation on the ground. The social dynamics of Darfur have changed. A lot of people have been displaced. 2 million people are in camps. Now 4 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. And this has created new realities on the ground. First of all, a number of IDPs cannot work their land anymore. And other people have moved onto their lands, which has changed the social fabric locally. And indeed, a lot of people are armed in Darfur. It's traditional. I mean, they defend their cattle, they defend their land. Many communities are armed in Darfur. And now the local aspects of conflict, especially with this massive wave of displacement, has taken a new face. A number of communities that used to live relatively peacefully together or coexist peacefully are now fighting over pieces of land. New realities have also emerged in this huge refugee camp. I'm sorry, IDP camps now in Darfur. They are almost little cities now.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. You talked about the three dimensions of the conflict, and I would like to offer a fourth, which is more the global sort of geopolitics dimension, and I think this gets short shrift a lot of places. What I'm referring to are things like the U.S. prior role in the region. People should remember that under the global war on terrorism, certainly a geopolitical global issue, Sudan was bombed. It looks like it was sort of a put-up false intelligence situation. That sounds crackpot, but an aide to a good friend of Clinton's, who was president when it happened, took the case, and I believe the investor got his money back for the damage to his factory. But in an impoverished nation like Sudan, having an aspirin factory or a pharmaceutical factory bombed under the allegation, soon refuted that it was a chemical weapons factory. I mean, that set back the whole region, actually. I think Sudan was actually exporting pharmaceuticals to other regions in Africa. And then there's the I can't believe the way the media doesn't report things. Blackwater, who, very publicly said that they would, intervene for free as if another militia in the region of problematic characters was going to solve anything. This was taken seriously by some liberal Hollywood types. I think Mia Farrow did a press conference with somebody from Blackwater. And what I'm reacting to is this was a perfect opportunity to try to investigate Blackwater's earlier role. You haven't mentioned anything about the South. The South is still volatile, too, in Sudan. A lot of this, I guess, goes back to the colonial boundaries set by Britain during its heyday of empire. But Blackwater was training rebels in the South to to and it had to be given okay by American policy. So basically, it was a private way of undermining. Don't get me wrong, I'm not apologizing for the regime, but there are a lot of awful regimes that don't get this kind of attention. And Blackwater, is also notorious, but the fact that they can offer to do something under the guise of humanitarianism when they were actually had a prior role in the south of Sudan, it's just it's mind-boggling to me, though I see so many examples of it. And I don't know how you would like to react to that, but I'd like for you to examine the broader role that Sudan is playing in this world situation.
Well, sure. Thank you very much for this comment. I'm glad you brought that up. What I would say, perhaps, about the U.S. policy in Sudan is the following. I mean, during the civil war between the North and the South, the U.S. government certainly supported the SPLA in the South with some training, with some money, some logistics, and also supporting a major humanitarian assistance operation in southern Sudan. And indeed, there was a lot of hostility against Khartoum. I mean, you have to remember that when this government in Khartoum took over in 1989, they were hardcore Islamists, Islamist fundamentalists. They had a very ideological discourse. And not only the American government, but also the entire region, the Ethiopians, the Eritreans, the Ugandans, decided to basically contain the expansion of fundamentalism into the region. So there was an agreement at the beginning of the 90s, mid-90s actually, that this needed to be done as a strategic objective. Now, this whole dynamic changed at the end of the 90s, at the beginning of the year 2000s, when the North and the South started negotiating a peace agreement. And at the time, there was also a change of administration between the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. And the Bush administration supported the peace process between the North and the South. They appointed a special envoy, which really actually helped the resolution of the process. So, they ended up signing this peace agreement in 2005. And here, what I should say is that the government of Sudan at that point in Khartoum was very much hoping to normalize relationship with the U.S. government. It was, in fact, one of the main incentives for them to sign the peace agreement with the South. They had just discovered oil in the what we call the transitional areas, the border between the North and the South, but also in southern Sudan. And they were very much hoping to sell their oil to international companies, including American companies. When September 11th happened, they immediately offered cooperation with the CIA, and they did give a lot of information to the CIA. I think they're still doing that. So the relationship changed, and it's become a very complex relationship. The Darfur crisis happened in 2003, and the reaction to the Darfur crisis became also a factor in U.S. policy. But as I described it, it's a complex set of relationship and with different factors to take into account. And so the reaction of the U.S. government to the Darfur crisis has to be taken into this context.
Yeah, there are quite a few things that are sort of loose ends. People would say that Sudan harbored Osama bin Laden for a while when he was sort of extracted from, I guess, Saudi Arabia at the time.
That's true.
But there actually are people that allege that this was okayed at the time by quite a few, including the U.S. government, in that they thought it would maybe stabilize Saudi Arabia a little bit. But at the time, the U.S. was actually using al-Qaeda types, not to say al-Qaeda period, in the Balkans. That's why I think that and the Dutch report on Srebrenica is a good source on some of those details, as well as there's a jurist that watched the trial of Milosevic. There are a lot of Byzantine complications anyway, I'll let those hang in the air, and thank you for your work.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me introduce once again our guest, Fabienne Hara. She is the Vice President for Multilateral Affairs at the International Crisis Group in New York, where she oversees the group's advocacy at the UN and the Security Council, also directs the New York Office of the Crisis Group. She has over 15 years of experience in African conflict management and resolution issues, including some time she spent with the UN mission in Sudan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm glad that the caller suggested that in addition to the three dimensions of the conflict and Darfur that you were talking about, local, national, and regional, there is an international dimension. Let me ask you about something else that has indeed gotten some attention in the international media, and that is the involvement of China as a supporter of the government of Sudan. What could you say about the extent of that support and whether, in fact, that somehow has made things worse?
Well, there are two dimensions here. Indeed, China has become, I would say, the major client of the government of Sudan in terms of the oil business. Not only China, also India, Malaysia, and other Asian countries, but China is in business with the government of Sudan. That's the bottom line. They are, you know, exploring a number of oil fields, and they have increasing business interests in Sudan. And this is partly also because the dynamics that I was talking about of normalization or possible normalization of relationship between the U.S. government and Khartoum didn't work out, in part because of what happened in Darfur. But so the government of Sudan has looked for, you know, companies that would buy their oil, even if the price they are selling their oil to the Chinese is a little lower than the price on the market. They know that the Chinese are less concerned with human rights issues. They are less concerned with interfering in sovereign affairs of the country, and so they have taken a role in the economy of Sudan. Now, they also have, to a certain extent, protected Sudan on the Security Council. They have made sure that, you know, the resolutions that were on the table to be negotiated by the Council would not go too far. For example, when there was a discussion on the peacekeeping force in Darfur, to be deployed to Darfur as a response to the crisis, the Chinese, but not only the Chinese, also the Russians and others in the Security Council, made sure that the consent of the government of Sudan was in the resolution. So in other words, that it would be a Chapter 6 resolution, not a Chapter 7, peacekeeping, not peace enforcement. So they have, to a certain degree, protected or given a certain degree of protection, diplomatic protection, to the government of Sudan. But I want to say two things here. I mean, first of all, people, a lot of activists, let's say, have talked about the influence of China on the government of Sudan. And after spending a couple of years in Sudan myself, I can certainly say that I believe that this influence has limitations. I don't believe any government on this planet has the ultimate influence on the government of Sudan. It's a very proud government, composed of people who have survived under sanctions and very difficult circumstances. A number of them are really hardcore Islamists and don't believe that the West should interfere in their affairs. And so, you know, even though China has an economic influence in Sudan, I wouldn't overestimate the political influence they have on this government, on this particular government, especially when it comes to issues of really survival of the government itself. And then the other thing I would like to say is that, you know, there are many African countries, non-aligned countries in general, that have, I wouldn't say sympathy for the government of Sudan, but that have some, you know, sympathy for the position of the government of Sudan. It's been depicted in the Arab world sometimes also as a, you know, an issue opposing the West against the Muslim world, or opposing the West against, you know, an African country. And so it's not only China, it's also a number of other countries that have come to support, you know, the government of Sudan's position.
One of earlier when you mentioned started out talking about there were these three dimensions. So maybe I'll ask you to talk about one other that I don't really think that we have touched on, and that is the how this involves the relationship between Sudan and Chad, which is the country to the west that borders on western and northern Darfur. And how does this play into this conflict?
That's a very good question. I mean, we can come back to the regional dimension of the conflict that I was mentioning at the beginning of the show. The government in Chad is a very fragile government. Politically, Chad is extremely unstable. You know, Chad was in a civil war for many years. And the government in place right now, the government of Idriss Deby, has faced a number of challenges in the last couple of years, internal challenges essentially, but also external challenges. And the internal challenges basically come from the decreasing legitimacy of the central government, the fact that it's considered as a minority government by many tribes in Chad, and many regional dynamics also have to be taken into account within Chad. So it's a strong military government, but it's also very fragile politically. The government of Sudan has taken advantage of these internal problems in Chad and has started now supporting the armed rebellion. I think it was about 2004 when they started doing that. And the government of Chad has lots of tribal links with some of the African tribes in Darfur. I mean, basically the ethnic mix is the same on both sides of the border. And they have supported the Darfur rebels from the beginning, from 2003. So basically what's going on between Sudan and Chad is a proxy war. They are not at war with each other, but they are, you know, fighting a proxy war through their respective rebel groups. And it's been going on for 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, this dimension of the crisis has not received enough attention. It has to be resolved through a serious bilateral dialogue between Chad and Sudan. And it will be a very essential foundation for the peace process in Darfur. I mean, if this is resolved, if the rebels stop getting support from the government of Chad, they will be most probably more inclined to speak to the government of Sudan and resolve the Darfur issue. So this is an issue that we in the International Crisis Group have been pushing a lot. It has to be part of the solution to the Darfur conflict.
We have made reference to the fact that there has been a long tension, animosity, and true war within Sudan between the north and the south, and this goes back to independence. It even predates independence. There was a period of something about 20 years of civil war. Then there was a break of about a decade, and then there was fighting started again in the early 80s and lasted until 2005. Now there apparently are some people who are concerned about where we are now with tensions between the north and the south, and whether this uneasy peace is going to hold, or whether there's some possibility that this north-south conflict could ignite once again.
Well, it's a very important dimension of the whole equation in Sudan, and I'm glad you mentioned this because most people tend to focus on Darfur as if Darfur was isolated from other dynamics going on in Sudan. And just to finish that thought, I can tell you that if the north-south peace process collapses, Sudan will fragment and it will be horrible. Right now there's a conflict in Darfur, but there's a government in Khartoum, a government of national unity, there's a national process going on. Now this process is extremely fragile, as you said. There are a number of provisions in the agreement that have not been implemented, that are still in dispute between the North and the South. It's partly due to the fact that this North-South Peace Agreement that we call the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, the CPA, has left a number of gaps when the parties negotiated it, and that these gaps are now being you know, addressed and discussed by the leadership of the two parties, or have to be addressed by the leadership of the two parties. They include the demarcation of the border between the north and the south. They include the status of the regions that are in the transition areas at the border between the north and the south. They include also the sharing of the oil wealth. That's a very contentious issue, obviously. And then they include the full redeployment also of the northern forces and the southern forces, both respectively to the north and to the south. I mean, right now, it's 3 years into the agreement. The two parties are still heavily armed. Politics is highly armed in Sudan, militarized, and there is no disarmament on either side. I mean, in the north, there is war in Darfur, so the Sudanese armed forces obviously continue recruiting and strengthening. And in the south, they don't trust the north, so they don't want to demilitarize, they don't want to disarm, and until they get to the referendum in 2011. Mm-hmm. So it's still a very fragile process, and recently we had some fears that this would collapse. And, you know, the tensions are also due to the resolution of the Darfur crisis. I mean, it is not easy for the SPLM, for the southern partner, the junior partner in government, to be in partnership with a government accused of, you know, the worst crimes against humanity. This is not something that, you know, many southerners like, obviously. But all of this being said, the main objective of the southerners is to get to 2011, to get to the referendum for self-determination. This is the major objective for them. This is what they've been fighting for so many years. This is why people have died in the south. They have an emotional attachment to the issue of self-determination that is so strong that I think they'll protect the peace process, the north-south peace process, at all costs. And this is right now what their priority is. I mean, it doesn't mean it cannot change between now and 2011. As I said, it's a very fragile process, but I believe at this stage that their commitment to the referendum is still stronger than anything else. Hmm. So we hope that the process will remain on track.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes perhaps left in this part of Focus 580. Fabienne Hara is our guest. She is with the International Crisis Group in New York, where she oversees their New York office and also oversees their advocacy at the UN and the Security Council. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about the Crisis Group and getting their analysis on various problem areas around the world, you can just go to their website. Just put in International Crisis Group and you will find it, and there's a lot of information available there. And questions also are welcome if someone wants to call quickly. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to talk a little bit more about the North-South conflict, this seems to be one of those places where there certainly are ethnic and religious dimensions. The North is mostly Muslim and has an Arab identification. The South is mostly Christian and has a more African kind of identification. And I suppose that might be a reason for conflict, but it seems that a rather more important one, or at least one we cannot forget, is actually, as is the case with a lot of other conflict that has these kind of dimensions, it's really about natural resources control and who gets to control the country's wealth and how what wealth exists gets divided up.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as I said, they've discovered that they had oil in the south, and so far the oil income has basically benefited to Khartoum. So when they negotiate the peace agreement, the CPA, the North-South Peace Agreement, they included a wealth-sharing protocol that basically says that 50% of the resources, the oil resources particularly, would go to southern Sudan. And this is very important because at this stage there is a semi-autonomous government in southern Sudan that had to be established from scratch, really. There has never really been a central administration in southern Sudan. So now there's a government in Juba, in the capital of southern Sudan. It has created a National Assembly and a number of other institutions. And for this government to survive, it definitely needs the income. Now, the big question in terms of wealth sharing is what happens after 2011? What happens if the South decides to be independent? If people vote in the referendum for self-determination? And this is one of the contentious issues that still need to be addressed between the North and the South. obviously, if the oil fields are mainly in the South should be able to benefit from the wealth. But this wealth also is important to the government in the North. So there are some discussions going on about what to do after 2011. In any case, the South is extremely underdeveloped. It's one of the, you know, if it was an independent country, it would be one of the poorest countries on earth. And they will need a lot of help. They will need a lot of infrastructure to actually be able to export this oil, number one, but also to spread the wealth of Southern Sudan to the population. And in terms of oil transport, for example, at this stage, the oil goes through Port Sudan, which is in eastern Sudan on the Red Sea. Port Sudan is part of northern Sudan. So they will have to find some sort of arrangement to transport this oil in any case. So this is also part of the discussion between the North and the South. Mm. But very importantly, in southern Sudan, whether they get access to income or not, they will have to invest very heavily in socio-economic development. This is really a country that needs to be built almost from scratch.
See, I would think that given the significance of the oil resource to the North, that people in the North would not look very favorably on the idea of independence for the South.
Well, this was the main issue in dispute. That's the reason for the war in the first place. And so we hope that at the end of the interim period, the Northerners and the Southerners will have found some sort of a post-referendum arrangement. But if they haven't, it's very likely that indeed the period around the referendum will be very unstable. It may even lead to a renewed war.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have someone calling in from up in the Rockford area, which is in the northern part of our state here, on a cell phone. So we'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
I'm sorry. My question had to do with what would happen if the referendum in 2011 went for the South to be independent. And so the question was being answered when I was asking it. So thank you for the answer.
Well, I'm sorry I grabbed your question not even knowing that that was what you were going to ask. Well, did you want to follow up, or did you want to take that any further? I agree. That seems to indeed be a very serious and important question.
Yeah, no, I think that 2011, even if they say yes, nobody wants to give up any money, especially if they're not sending it down to the South already anyway. So I think there's going to be a long time period here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what, you know, this discussion on southern Sudan also implies is that Sudan is really a very complex country. It has this huge issue in Darfur to resolve. It has this huge issue of possible separation of the South to resolve in the next couple of years. There are national elections supposed to happen next year, the first one at the national level in the country's history. I mean, it's facing a number of very complex and very challenging processes at the same time. And frankly, it's a lot for one country to cope. I you know, in my experiences of other peace processes, I mean, the issues of I think it's one of the most complex, you know, peace process that I've ever seen, and it's going to be very challenging.
Well, we're coming down to the point. We have a couple of minutes left, and just to talk about that a little bit more, given everything that we discussed and the problems with the conflict and the fact that we've got a humanitarian crisis going here of significant dimension and many parties involved. Then the question is, well, what can outside parties, outside governments, the United Nations, what really can be done to try to manage this conflict or at least keep it from getting any worse?
Well, number one, I think we have to protect the Comprehensive Peace Agreement at all costs. Unfortunately, a lot of attention, I mean, I couldn't say unfortunately, it's maybe a little overstated, but a lot of attention has been put on Darfur, on the resolution of the Darfur issue, and not enough on the North-South dynamic. And as I said, I think it's a key foundation for peace in Sudan. So we have to, we as international community have to protect the peace agreement between the North and the South. and invest political capital, invest diplomatic efforts to make sure that this remains on track. And then the second thing I think we need to do is restart the peace process in Darfur, but connecting it to the North-South peace process, connecting it also to the problem with Chad, and trying to address all the dimensions that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. Local dimension is really important in Darfur to resolve. The national dimension, again, could be connected to the CPA and to the dynamic of elections next year, and the regional dimension needs to be addressed. So a more strategic effort by the international community is needed, particularly on the political aspect.
You know, it seems this is a story that has gotten off and on a fair amount of attention in the international media from people, particularly from people, commentators who are saying, look, we have a very serious humanitarian crisis here. And the governments of the world, particularly the governments of the United States, haven't been paying as much attention as they should. Given the fact that it has gotten that attention, why, I wonder, does it not have a higher priority, and I suppose does that indeed reflect the fact that it's not easy, that it is difficult?
Well, I think you answered your own question. I mean, partly it is partly because it's difficult that there is not more discussion on the overall problem in Sudan in the media. It's also because it's complex, as I said. I mean, there are lots of different drives. Supports, you know, the separation of the South. I mean, it's a major commitment also for the international community to do that. We don't know whether that's going to go peacefully or not. And then the public opinion, you know, public opinion pressure to resolve the crisis in Darfur, to address the human rights aspect of the crisis is immense, unprecedented, I would say, for an African conflict. And this also is taking, you know, the government, particularly the government of the U.S., but also European government, into a direction that is not necessarily, you know, the most strategic one in terms of the political process and the political resolution of the crisis. So I think we are all pulled in very many different directions, and that's why I'm calling for a deeper assessment of the problems and a more strategic response to it and a more political response to it. Mm.
Well, there we'll have to leave things with our thanks to our guest, Fabienne Harris. She is Vice President for Multilateral Affairs at the International Crisis Group in New York, where she oversees their office and oversees advocacy at the UN and the Security Council in New York. If you're interested, again, to find out more about the Crisis Group, to read about this issue, you can go to their website, which is www.crisisgroup.org. Ms. Hara, thank you very much.
Thank you.